Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of We Didn't Know How Good We Have It. And I'm really pleased to announce that I'm being joined by Junior and Lexi of Your Poetry and Johnny Foreigner fame. Guys, how are you?
Hi.
Fantastic.
We're good.
Good. As good as we can be, I guess, is the phrase that keeps popping up.
Uh-huh. To the extent that I'm kind of bored of saying it. I think I'm just going for denial now. Like, I'm fine. Why wouldn't I be?
But you've been really busy though, haven't you, with songwriting and stuff for people. Yeah, that's been quite a lucrative thing and you know.
I have, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to, I kind of feel almost guilty landing like dream job when so many other people losing their whole jobs. But I'm very aware it can only last for like, there's a very limited pool of people who likes Johnny Foreigner enough to want to pay me money now to write songs. So I feel like I'm hoping that doesn't run out before normality ensues.
No, I feel like I've said to a few people the whole, you know, pandemic sort of starting beginning of last year makes you think like, oh, what should I have done with my time? And there's this whole, I don't know, I felt to myself the pressure to do something with this lots of free time that a lot of people found themselves with. But it sort of got to the point in the second one when I was like, actually, there's nothing wrong with not doing anything. But if you can all of a sudden find something to do that works for you with the time, then, you know, all better for it, really.
Yeah, totally.
You were really productive for the start of it. The first few months, I just stayed in bed.
Yeah, but I had that crazy idea to do a song a day. Which turned out to be like a song a day, maybe, or one after 4 days, 5 days, depending on how long WAVs take to send an email. But then, yeah, I just did that, and then I just got better at using Logic and all that stuff. So it was good. Productive, but I had to work in between as well. And obviously, I've got a daughter, and discovering new parts of Birmingham is pretty cool as well. So
nice getting out there and just seeing the parts that, I mean, I'm surprised that you guys don't know everywhere already, but you know, it's always good to go out there and just discover something.
Lewis Harriet showed me this nice place near where he lives. It's like Lower Bittle, doesn't matter, no one will know, but it's very nice. I recommend it, guys. Lower Bittle Reservoir, you see alpacas, the horses, you know.
Nice, everyone's going banging on Lewis's door now. Like, tell us about this place. So it's talking about Lewis, it's, you know, if you don't mind, we'll talk about Johnny Foreigner for a few minutes, because we've had a few guests on that have brought you guys up because, you know, they loved you, love you still. George Gadd had incredibly good things to say, and Ben Forrester as well. Sort of, I don't want to go into the whole like, oh, how did it start, all that type of thing, but how did being in that band, around these bands that you're going to talk about over the next sort of half an hour or so, how did being in that band sort of help you sort of get to where you are now, I suppose?
We sponged our ideas off the bands we're going to talk about now.
Oh, okay, that's an incredibly honest answer.
But no, when you hear of people like how old would George have been when we started playing, like 14 or something? But that idea that there's people younger than us that are still listening to stuff, it feels really flattering in that we're fitting into the chain, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like when we were starting out, then it was, I guess, to an extent, the bands we were going to talk about. But like, that's my one consistent happy memory of Johnny Foreigner, is that like, it feels very complete. We started off fanboying over people and trying to keep our cool, and it's ended up people fanboying over us and trying to keep our cool.
I think I've probably mentioned to you in the past, but I remember the first time I came across Johnny Foreigner was when I was back in school. Obviously not showing my age there, but I think I was handed a mixed CD that my friend had made, and it had Spinderella on it.
Right.
And I was going to Reading and Leeds Festival, going to Reading Festival that year, and you were playing, I think, the Festival Republic stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of brought this story up with Ben when I did the chat with him, where I remember seeing how packed the tent was there. Now, when I was 16 or whatever it was, 1,000 people felt like an insane amount of people, but it really was. And the impact it had on me was thinking, there's a band from where I'm from that all these people love, and it made me feel like part of what you were doing. Without, I didn't know you guys then, but it made me feel a part of something. And you know, I thought I'd just obviously put that out there, because that's the feeling that a lot of people I've spoken to about you guys sort of seem to have as well.
That's what like all our favorite bands have, that same thing as well. It's a very like inclusive kind of vibe.
Yeah,
you found it, you get it, you're part of the family, congratulations.
we were saying with George Gadd when we brought up a couple of the shows at the Flapper, where you could go to one of those shows on your own and all of a sudden you're sat around a table outside on the patio with, you know, 12 other people wearing Johnny Foreigner or Los Campesinos t-shirts and things like that. You know, it's part of that big
mostly community Los of people.
No, definitely.
He brought up there was a Dr. Martin's show, I think he said it was, and it was you guys in Los Camp. Lots of skinny jeans and tight t-shirts and sing-alongs, I think, was the vibe that day.
No pointy shoes. So it's all
because we're all strapped into Doc Martens. I think I had such an argument with them because I didn't want to wear them on stage because I ordered, like, obviously, like, they're like, have a free pair of Doc Martens. So I was like, I'll have the most expensive pair, please. And they're these big clumpy bastards and my pedals are quite small.
Does it take you half an hour to put on?
Yeah.
Did you sell them afterwards?
No, I kept them.
Yeah. Someone stole mine from the work.
Oh, bastards. Oh. Weddings and funerals. That's what they're for.
You know what? There's a photo of you at Kelly's wedding wearing them.
Nice. They've had some use then. That's right. So Doc Martens haven't given free stuff away without any use. So that's all right.
But they're good for show.
Well, what I'll do is I'll send this. Hopefully, I need to get a sponsor. So I'll send this to Doc Martens and we'll see what we can get hold of.
Trying to think, going back to that Reading show, one of my memories is seeing a poster for us, huge one, next to the main stage almost. Had people pissing on it. I thought that was
it's kind of a privilege, Christmas isn't it? Card from James, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of a privilege.
Agent sent it as a Christmas card.
But people are only doing it because you've got a poster there so close to the main stage.
Yeah, if the poster wasn't there, they wouldn't be able to do that. Yeah. So you know, you've got to take it as it comes.
Is that when Fight Like Apes were backstage? Was that a different one?
That's way different.
Yeah.
That was the Reading was we played Reading Festival and then everyone talks about that, but no one talks about the evening where we headlined over Metallica playing Guitar Hero in the community bar
at
the end of the campsite.
was that 2007, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
2000.
Slipknot played, Metallica played.
Yeah. It's Rage Against the Machine and Metallica.
Yeah.
I remember Sean, but we took one of our best friends, Sean, there. And he came, and he basically just really wanted to see Metallica because he's a huge fan of Backstreet Boys and Metallica.
Oh, wow, okay.
But the first night, or two nights, he was just passed out drinking too much tequila around the tent. But then he woke up on the one night, and I remember calling him saying, come on, Sean, come to backstage because we've got to do this Guitar Hero thing. And we're being filmed playing Guitar Hero, and then in walked Metallica, and he shat his pants. We played everything, all the B-sides, didn't we? Like everything we'd never played before.
I just remember being wrecked.
We played like Camp Kelly Calm after not playing it for like 5 years. It was mad.
Nice. So, I mean, obviously, let's get to the crux of this. Obviously, me taking up your time on what is right now a Monday evening, whoever knows is listening to it in the future, whatever day that is. We're here to talk about bands that, obviously, specifically for you guys, have sort of helped either guide your songwriting or you've been influenced by or you just absolutely love. That are unfortunately no longer together for whatever bunch of reasons. If you want to start us off with, you know, I've got a couple of bands here that I've written down that you've given me. If you want to start off with any of those?
So if we go in chronological-ish order, I guess Dystopia is the band we should talk about first.
So those guys, they're from the West Midlands, aren't they, as well? I don't want to keep saying their band's from Birmingham because I keep doing that because I appreciate people are from spread all over the West Midlands. But
Solihull.
Yeah, Solihull.
Oh, very posh.
Solihull band.
So how did you sort of come across those guys? What's their story?
I met Pete at college when we were 17, 18-ish. Mm-hmm. 18, 19-ish. Years ago. Pete's always played in a band called Dystopia. Like, that was his band. And, like, I recorded them. They sounded like a bit like The Offspring and a bit like Green Day, and we'd make, like, these shit demos on my 4-track. And then they just kind of, like, progressed and progressed until they got to, I think, the album that we want to talk about, Beat Dyslexia. And it was such an amazing leveling up. Like, I remember the first show they played when they had John in the band and they'd written those songs. It was like, I have goosebumps talking about it. It was like standing by the side of the stage watching Weezer bust out Pinkerton for the first time or something. Like, it was just so colorful and they were so tight and the harmonies and everything were so on point. And then the album came out and it was just like, it was perfect. And it's
That's a big statement. I like that.
It still is perfect, though, isn't it?
It really is. I went through, we wanted to do dystopia, but we kind of also wanted to talk a bit about, the Staries or Sunshine or something. And then, so I went through listening to loads of old songs and then put the dystopia album on and then just kind of sat paralyzed over the laptop for 40 minutes. It's just
I was listening to Dystopia on Spotify earlier on, and it said, they had so many listeners in the world, and it came up number one being Birmingham. I was like, I bet that's Lexi and Junior sticking it back on and just getting back into it again.
Totally. I don't think the album's on Spotify though, is it? I think the singles one.
No, I struggled to find the album. There's a few singles on there. Robert Redford was a good one. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, the album Beat Dyslexia is just perfect. If you haven't heard it, you need to sort that right out.
Well, Pete's gone on to do sort of a lot. Pete Dixon, obviously, for people who don't know him by first name. Yeah, he's done a lot of things, hasn't he? Especially Junior's in one of the... I still don't want to say project, it's not the right word, but I feel like everything that... this goes back to another conversation I've had. Everything that happens in Birmingham, sort of around you guys in a way, there's so many musicians that, you know, everyone's in every other band. Stuff Dave from Sunshine is in Mayors of Toronto, and then you've got Craig is in Mutes, and then all sorts .
Used to feel like that to me.
It didn't, no. It used to be, but it was more like people just trying to find out who they fit with, working out different combinations. Yeah. We always used to look up to the Liverpool scene because there everyone played in everyone's bands, Hot Club and all their friends. And there was no ego or anything about it. Whereas back in Birmingham at the time, this is your band, this is my band. And now I think at least our little slice of the scene, everyone's kind of coalesced and matured, and we're a lot more of that Liverpool ethos now.
Totally. It's awesome.
Than we were when we were starting out.
Liverpool's like Chicago.
Yeah.
Do you think that makes it easier for bands now, especially in the West Midlands? I mean, when I was playing, 7, 8, 9 years ago, it wasn't quite, I agree with you, it wasn't quite like everyone was in everyone else's bands. I think it's quite a new thing, maybe 5, 6 years or so that's been.
For us, but maybe it's just an age thing. Maybe it is. The other people that were our age when that wasn't happening, maybe they were in each other's band. I'm not too sure, to be honest.
I think it's just a thing about being in bands, isn't it? When you're in your 20s and you're playing in bands, and half the people are there because they want to be a famous pop star. They want that lifestyle. And then by the time you get to your 30s, everyone in bands, no one's there for the money or the dreams anymore. You were all just doing it out of the sheer bloody mindedness and just the love of the game, as opposed to hoping it's going to bring us something.
So
definitely, I think age is part of it.
Do you feel you find more time for other musicians then, I guess? Is that the thing? Because I know Junior's done a lot of stuff and you've done a lot of stuff, Lexi, where you work with other people where you can hear just one thing from them and you go, actually, I'd like to invest some of my time in what they're doing and help guide them in one way or another or work with them, etc.
Kind of, yeah. I don't think it's never really been consciously like that, but there's definitely a pattern of people. You admire people and they admire you, and so naturally you end up working, and chances are you're taking stuff from the same reference points and you have vaguely the same endpoint in mind, so it all comes together a lot better.
Okay, so just moving back onto Dystopia and stuff, obviously they're one of the first bands that you said, was it about 15 years ago? I don't mean to obviously drop ages and stuff in about 15 years ago, but that shows that the sort of longevity of bands like that in people's minds. Now, we're not talking the Rolling Stones and bands of, 50, 60 years old. I'm talking local bands that mean stuff to people, the longevity of what that means. That
Beat Dyslexia is exactly one of them albums, isn't it? That if you're somewhere and someone doesn't know and you go, oh, haven't you heard it? Put this on. By the third song, they're just like, well, how did this not get to my ears at the time?
Do you remember when we were touring America with Evan Bernard? I think we were doing the drive from, where was it? Philadelphia or New York to Boston. I can't remember, but there was a snowstorm.
I
just put it on and he couldn't believe it. It was like, what is this? Why am I not
doing crazy? It helps that you're trapped in a van and you've got nowhere to escape to, so you've got to absorb it in a different way.
Yeah, no, mind was blown. He was just annoyed at himself for never discovering it. But I'm that's the whole point. That's part of it, isn't it?
And also I realised when we were starting out and we do kind of, when Johnny Foreigner was starting out and we do pre-production with people, so we'd send them a handful of records and be like, this is what we want to take from. Mm-hmm. And I think we'd send them Captain Jazz, like that An Alpha, like 8-track EP.
Yeah.
And Sad Sappy Sucker by Modest Mouse, which is recorded on a potato in a barn somewhere. And Urasai, which is Pavement via Scottish, recording in a barn somewhere. And Beat Dyslexia.
Yeah.
And all of the, we were so, people would just be like, well, you sent us an album of people screaming on a 4-track and it's out of tune and what are you doing?
And like, exactly.
Yeah. But it's only like listening back that like, that like Beat Dyslexia is gold and the production on that still sounds so fresh. Whereas everything else, you are like, oh yeah, didn't notice that at the time.
That's, do you reckon it's like sort of that those Modest Mouse records and stuff, it kind of didn't matter in like a respectful way that it was out there then. People would listen to it regardless then.
And I think that's part of what makes this record so good is that they all kind of knew that and they knew they didn't want to make like that album Soda Lake, the album before, the songs on it are not quite as strong, but in the same ballpark. But the production is very much downgraded and you can't really pick bits out. Whereas that, it just feels like they went, and we want to make a pop album.
Yeah.
So everything is present and everything interacts with each other and every song feels crafted, I want to say.
It's one of those, I guess, you write songs as a four-piece or whatever, and then when you start recording it, you go, oh, actually, that melody that someone's playing on the guitar, let's bring that up a bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
We wrote that in the song because we want people to hear it. Let's almost like force it into their ears in certain parts of the song.
And I think because we know them as people, you can listen to it and be like, oh, that's like all the glitchiness and the weird stuff is Seb's doing. And then like, you know, the pavement-y background shouts are all going to be Tom's doing. And you can tell like it's everyone's kind of at the top of their game and working together. But even if you don't know them, like it's still breathtaking. It's such a perfect record.
When I was doing a bit of research into them earlier on, I noticed that Tom, John and Seb formed Burning Arms after that. Yeah. And it got me remembering that I remember playing a show with them at the station in King's Heath with Alarm Bells, who are Dan and Nanananan Aykroyd. Afterwards thing. And like that to me at the time, I was playing with Dan and Aykroyd. And like I said, I was slightly, how do I sort of word it? It's just aside to the scene. If that, without knowing you guys, I suppose having that lucky connection of meeting you that one day, I wouldn't really know. Until we got into the King's Heath scene, that's when I sort of noticed that it seems like everybody who lives in King's Heath is in a band or has been in a band or supports a band that, you know, and it's a super, it was a super lovely place to be. But I remember watching them going, oh, these guys are good. I wonder how long they've been going for. And now doing the research, I realize it's respectfully quite a long time. And they've obviously, the reason they're good is because they've crafted it and they've had a lot of passion in it for quite a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And let's move on to another act here. If you wouldn't mind me putting one of the band I'd like to talk about is Hot Club de Paris.
Sure.
Because I know they were, you know, one of the standout bands in sort of the mid to late 2000s, I would guess, with a lot of people, with the music journalists and as well as their fans and stuff as well. If you want to go into them for a bit, that'd be great.
I feel like I was so close to calling you this morning and asking if we could swap Hot Club out for Sunset Cinema Club.
Oh, well, we can do full honourable mentions or just carry on with Sunset if you like. This is your chance to, like I said, a big nostalgia trip.
It really is.
I feel they definitely, both of them never released a song that wasn't at least 8 out of 10. And both of them took elements of music that we kind of don't fuck with, like the funk and that kind of thing, and then contextualize it to us in a way that seemed amazing. But I just didn't want to drone. I didn't want us to be droning on about Birmingham forever. So Hot Club were kind of like our gateway band. The first show, the first time we saw them, we played with them on Sunset Cinema Club at the Flatbed.
It was like the best lineup.
Jesus.
Honestly.
I said this would be a nostalgia trip.
No, right. It really was. I'm trying to find, everyone post a picture every now and again. It's like Greg did the artwork and it's like a yellow poster.
Yeah.
I can't remember who else was playing, but hundreds of people even, I think, were playing as well. I need to find it. But I remember we didn't know who they were, did we? We were pretty naive. And then we were having a joint outside the side bit. And then we heard Clockwork Tie on the guitar, and I've still got the video somewhere. I'm basically filming, I can't remember what I was filming, and then I just heard the tappy bit of that, and we just stared at each other. Oh my God, I remember open that mode. Video. Unbelievable that was. And then we just, yeah, became hooked and yeah. friends and obsessed.
They gave us our first show out of Birmingham, I think. They hooked us up with, I want to say, Simon.
So, yeah, yeah.
With the Simon. Blonde.
Yeah, I remember him. Stole his music library. Not stole, yeah. He gave it to me, but it was...
He put a show. He put a show on, and we went in Liverpool, and we went and played that, and then came home, and then you and me took the train up the next day to go back to Liverpool to go to some party that Hot Club had invited us to.
Oh, yeah.
And they played. It was just some warehouse party or something. It was like no, it's like an indie night.
It was an indie night at a pub, and they played on the stage. Was like a
yeah, because it's an indie night in Liverpool, they do things like they'd play Owls and the dance floor. Like people wouldn't rush off the dance floor, and that's I think. Like we spent ages saying Birmingham was crap compared to other places, and then it's only when we started to go to other places, it's like, nah, I was totally right.
So much better. That's an opinion, by the way, for anyone listening there.
and that's changed.
That's the tale. This is different now.
There's one thing I just want to point out with a lot of these bands, having listened to me over the last few days after you sent me the list, there's something that I spotted that sort of fits really well with specifically your songwriting, Lexi, that it's the... It's almost like storytelling. I know people say that stuff about music anyway, but the way that lyrics are sung and the way that everything fits together, the song is a story, like everything from where the kick drum lies to where that top guitar melody, everything is right. is a story.
Yeah. There's, I'm showing off my film ignorance, but who's the guy that did the film of the Rolling Stones, like a famous tour film?
Oh, I'm going to have to look that up.
This is a famous beardy... intellectual filmmaker, and he did like it was just a Rolling Stones concert. But someone, I read an interview where someone was asking him why he's such an amazing director, but all he'd done was film the band. And he was going, well, I don't need to interview the band because there's a story. Every time the old Johnny Depp guy plays his guitar, there's a story in that. Like that the hand movement is wrought from like 6 years playing these decadent London clubs, and everything's in the music already if you know where to look.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I love pop music so much, is that there is a story in everything. So
that's
yeah.
really profound. That was I didn't realize that was going to get as deep as that then. I like that. That's probably the most intellectual thing I think anyone said on all of these podcasts so far. But yeah, like I genuinely mean that, like from like bottom to top in any song, your songwriting as a group as well, I mean, it's just your poetry or Johnny Foreigner, it reflects a lot in these bands that you've chosen to talk about as well. And like I know you joked earlier that you rip their music off and whatever, you just take people's ideas and stuff, but when you listen to bands of this quality and stuff, it's kind of hard to not be influenced by any of it, because most of these acts as well, but you know them all probably really well personally and stuff, they take it as an incredible compliment that something that they wrote influenced you to get to where you are in the end of an album or the end of an EP or the end of a single.
Yeah, I would hope so. Like I said, it's all part of being in the chain.
Or they could hate it, obviously.
There is that. Jumping ahead to the next band that we're talking about. I won't say their name to reveal it yet, but it was the point where we played with them, and me and Kelly like were in love with this band, and we followed them out to their bus, like carrying their merch for them. And we're like, so like, what kind of music do you listen to? And they turned around and were like, Guns N' Roses, the Ramones, like guitar, rock music. And we're just like, how did you get there? How did you get to where you are now from that? And so this is exactly what I'm talking about. There's a lot in common, I think.
I suppose, is that you saying that you like listening to Guns N' Roses? Yeah. There's a big head shake there for those who can't see what's going on. Okay, yeah, I suppose I'll tell you what, you've brought up. Who is the next band then? Just to put that a name to that story.
Managua, I think we're deciding how.
Yeah, well, I'm a Brummie, so I was like Managua.
We've always said Managua. Managua. Willful mispronunciation, but I think the correct terminology is Managua.
Managua, and those guys are from Brooklyn, aren't they?
Brooklyn, yeah, yeah.
I think they're the first act out of anyone that I've interviewed that are from America as well. So
really,
you've broken through a glass ceiling there that I hope someone would eventually break through.
Amazing. I feel like it was hard to pick English bands.
Well, like I said, yeah. Everyone just picked Johnny Foreigner and every other chap that I seem to spoke about. So, you know, your top of the list is, you know, that's how it works. How did you come across these guys then? Because I'll be honest with you, I couldn't really find out a fat lot about them other than they were from Brooklyn, and I listened to their record earlier, and it's fucking great.
It was definitely your discovery, and then you were like, listen to this.
Yeah, but I forget how. I'm going to say MySpace. I'm going to say friends on MySpace had it. The kid Bob Dole, do you remember him?
Rings a bell.
One really early Johnny Foreigner shows in Nottingham.
That
era where you could just go, hey, stranger on the internet, I notice you like the same obscure music that I do. Can we be friends? And there was nothing creepy about it. That's how we got into Menagra. I think they did a split with Rapid Than Horsepower when they were called Cheryl's Magnetic Aura as well. And it took a while to realize that that was the same band. So yeah, for ages, there were just like demos and bits and bobs floating around the internet. And I think the album is a compilation of demos, or it's a collection of EPs. There's a certain point, some songs on the album don't sound like they're recorded with the same attention as other songs do. Like, it sounds like different sessions. But just in terms of songwriting, that album is phenomenal.
I think when I looked up earlier on, they said that it was basically released once and then no one really sort of bought it or listened to it. And then it was like remixed and reproduced and re-released again, which is why, like, I guess why some of the tracks, like you said, they sound a bit disjointed from each other. They may have the same sort of structure or songwriting techniques and things, but they sound like they jump out of a record a little bit more than some of the others. But yeah, that might be it.
And like the same as Dystopia, the songs feel like very crafted, like everyone knows what the fuck they're doing and they're on it. And it doesn't have like quite the same, like Dystopia has this big scope to it with all the extra stuff, whereas they're very much, this is what we're going to sound like, and now we're going to sound like it as perfectly as possible. And yeah.
So it's like boiling it down to what they're perfect for. I suppose the kind of like antithesis of like what I said earlier, where it's like, we wrote that little tiny guitar melody there, we want everyone to hear it. It's kind of like, if it doesn't have to be there, don't chuck it in. Chuck it in when it matters.
Yeah. It's very, very like, so when stuff happens, it really matters that it happens. There's like an emotional heft to every component.
Because that comes with that whole writing music as a musician for musicians is putting in those little things that you know, you listen to it in a good pair of headphones or a shit pair of headphones, you hear those little things. But if you're writing like words, I suppose words mean a lot more to people than guitar lines and stuff like that, because people can't necessarily relate to a guitar line, but they can relate to words in however sort of way that they want. So I guess that's part of it, where, you know, if you think you're going to be surrounded by musicians, which I guess is why a lot of Birmingham bands, again, that we've been talking about, works, because they're surrounded by musicians at shows as well. So can you imagine you're writing a track and, like, oh, for example, Ulex like, might be writing a guitar line and you might make it that little tiny bit more complicated than you originally intended, but it works. But also at the same time, you know, like, for example, Pete from Sunshine, and go, I like that. Like, the extra thing that's in there that makes it for a sort of slightly different audience, I guess.
I think Pete shreds on guitar. Like, I think he knows enough to know that the little things I do are more parlor tricks to fool people who aren't musicians into thinking that I'm a good musician. Like, there's stuff that is relatively easy and doesn't require much knowledge to pull off. But if you're watching, you're like, oh, that's pretty cool.
So I remember watching, like I said, the Reading show. I keep saying Reading and Leeds because it's always glued together, isn't it? The Reading show.
The Leeds show was awful.
Oh, okay. We won't bring that one up then. I can't say it was there, so we'll just pretend it didn't happen, that one. But I remember watching you, and I think I'd been playing guitar for maybe 4 years or something like that. And I remember watching you play. And this is me guffing, by the way, everyone. Apologies. But I didn't realise you didn't use a pick. Because of the way that you play is so like precise, which you'd imagine with someone using a guitar pick. Again, this is probably boring junior now, so the guitar talk.
No, I like playing guitar.
I think it's also the first time I watched someone, like physically watched someone tap on a guitar and realized, right. I was like, oh, how are you doing that thing? And then also going straight back to using your hand and stuff. And I think from maybe sitting in your poetry rehearsals and stuff by accident and watching your player going, I could never do that. My hand would be in shreds and like I'd be complaining the whole time about it rather than it, but you seem to have made it. I don't think people realize it. It's your own sort of style that, and that shows in a lot, well, all of the music, I guess, that you've written.
You've definitely shredded your hand a few times, though.
Yeah, the first year of solid touring, like my nail was basically split down the middle and hanging. It was gross.
Why don't you use a pick? And again, this is a really boring question for people to hear, but like it changes the melody, the timbre of you playing your guitar anyway, so it adds to it. But why don't you use a pick?
It were an accident. So I wanted to play guitar when I was a little kid, and my parents kind of both dabbled in music a little bit. And my mum played like classical, like Spanish guitar.
Yeah.
And so when I spoke to her about playing guitar, she was like, no, you don't use a plectrum. And that just kind of lodged in my head. And so for years, I thought using a plectrum was like a completely optional thing.
Yeah.
And it was only to the point where I started playing with other people. And I was like, do you use a plectrum? And everyone's like, yeah. And it was only later on I realized that I had that advantage that I can switch styles without having to do like the like little magician's trick of hiding
it. Because I've tried like recreating your style, but using a guitar pick and stuff, and be like, you can't do it without years and years of practice, I guess. But I suppose in a good way for you, if it was natural from the start, right, you didn't have to figure it out, if that makes sense. Like, it was already drilled into you, I guess. Then you were cheating, I suppose, is the best way.
I only learned about palm mutes last year. Yeah, before playing with, I told you I'd eat you, because I thought they were just called palm mutes because they sounded like you were resting your palm on. I thought what you actually did was put your fingers between the strings and kind of use each finger like a piano mute.
Yeah.
And so that's how I palm mute. So I can never play more than two strings at the same time palm muting. And then watching that, I was like, how do you get that sound? And he was like, with my palm.
Yeah, the palm part of the palm mute.
I can't pull that off for shit. My hand is just way too unstable. The same with like drilling as well, and like really heavy, hard attacky stuff. Like I can move my hand really fast, but it doesn't have the same constant attack as a plectrum does.
But that again, that goes into the style and the songwriting, I guess, because you can do a little bit more. We'll talk about snare rolls in a second, if you want, like, cause that's the only drum part that I can really talk about. You know, that sweet wrist action.
One theoretical drummer ever.
And I banned Junior from having rack toms when we started. Because ideologically, I just feel rack toms are a stupid compromise.
Oh, so, compromise to what, though?
Well,
keyboard, obviously.
That makes sense. Yeah, if anyone knows Junior's layout, it's a drum kit with a keyboard gaffer taped onto it somewhere, right?
A floor tom is a statement, right? Whereas a rack tom is kind of like, it's either not quite a statement or it's leading up to a floor tom.
Just a passing note, basically, for the
drums. Yeah. Better. So keyboard did you way better.
Is that so you're saying, so Junior can roll from snare and then play a full keyboard set and then move on to his floor
tom? No, you see, I never mastered the Nate Kinsella make-believe vibe. But no, it's just the one-handed thing in it. You know, you can play drums with one hand and use the other one for your keyboard, which you should always have rather than a rack tom, obviously.
Okay, you heard it here first, guys, there. So if you can get rid of your rack toms, keyboards the way through. I actually borrowed a microcork from someone, I borrowed a microcork from someone, and I set it up and everything, and just looked at it and went, I don't even know where to start. So fair play for being able to play another instrument whilst playing another instrument as well. That's always something to admire. And let's go on about, I was going to do a Brummie accent. I am from Birmingham. I'm not going to do the Brummie accent. Let's go about Managua again, just for a little bit longer. That, obviously, you're saying that you helped them carry merch and stuff, and realise that sort of side, but what was sort of their influence on you, really, like, aside from finding them on MySpace?
It was like, obviously, part, like, the great part of it is the songs were just incredible earworms that stayed in your head, and you're never quite sure what they're about, but whatever it was, it's definitely the situation you're in right now. But you can never quite, like, it's that idea of using like just under enough detail to show the full picture. But it was also the fact that they just came across like, we were huge fans before we watched them, and then watching them, we were just like besotted, because they were like, it was like watching a cartoon. Like, we were talking about like Christian, like we think it's Christian, the bass player, and he's the archetypal Brooklyn bass player, and every hit is solid and perfect, and like, they were just, yeah, they were like cartoons. Like the guitarist with like, and it's the ultimate, like the Brooklyn trope of like the dude with the glasses and his little shakur, and then he's got a jazz master with the whammy and shit like that. And the singer kind of like pure, doesn't give a fuck. When they, the second show we played with them.
Was that the Brudenell?
Yeah. The second show they looked at, like, we played at the Brudenell. So we played. And then they were like, nah, we're going to play on the floor. And so moved everything, all their stuff onto the floor and just played in a circle. And it was...
It blew me away. It was insane. It was so tight. I think that influence for me was mainly just how on point they were with their, you know, stages of sound and game.
Yeah.
It was so tight to the point it sounded like the record and it just could be anywhere in the room. It was just pinpoint.
I think they're the one band in these four bands that we've picked that could play the record perfectly from start to finish. There's nothing on that record that isn't in the live set, because to them, you feel like that's the point of a record, is to capture the essence of like a live band.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, everyone else we picked, I think, fucks with that formula to a certain extent. There's like all the weird digital stuff from Beat Dyslexia, and then there's even like a bit of glitching on the Screaming Maldini album. But it's all stuff like using the studio as like another layer of artifice. So the studio is your tool as opposed to just the thing that represents what you do.
Hopefully you get a lot more time in a studio than you do live. But if you sit and listen to a track, let's say if you just record drums, bass, guitar, vocals, you've got so much more time to listen to that, to add those little things. And like we said before, like Managua, the idea is, or what we think is, to strip it back to the stuff that it does, that stuff that doesn't have to be there. If they can do that live, that's perfect. I mean, I again, coming from a musician standpoint, I love hearing little things that bands put into a record that you think, oh, they're not going to be able to do that. Like a little tiny synth thing. Let's take like just any Johnny Foreigner track for record. You could be sitting there putting a little synth melody in that you might not think many people will hear in the track, but it's there. Like you just hit a sample pad or press a key and it is there. And I love that little nod to people, really, I guess, that for listening deeper into a record than...
Yeah.
Some.
I feel like we really flipped. Like our second album was pure, just record it. Like that. There's very like it was made by like Alex Newport, and it's very much the English school of production where you press record, and then when the band taps on the window, you press stop, and you're done.
Yeah, and he sat and there so with his feet up. Hard day's work.
Immensely skilled man, getting everything to sound to where we can play it properly and good in the first place. But like. Then the third album, we were just like, throw everything at the wall and treat the studio like a tool. And then the fourth album was scaled back. And then the last album was just use the studio as a tool again. I definitely feel like we oscillate between one extreme or the other.
How much, I'll sort of go into a thing later on, but how much of the records, the Johnny Foreigner records specifically, did you record in the Blotto Studios or the Lockup, as I keep calling the Blotto Studios?
The last one was everything, wasn't it?
Everything on the last one. You Can Do Better. I think we had some place in Cottridge to do the drums.
And I think I remember being with you when you did the vocals, some of the vocals for You Can Do Better.
Vocals, yeah. And then before that, Versus was done.
Everywhere, wasn't it?
We did the instruments to that in the Lockup and did the vocals at Dom's house.
Well, then we also did some, like Super Morning, for example. All the drums were done in Dom's house. He had a kit in the corner. We'd done the piano in his school. Theatre. It was all over the place. It was great.
I'll ask you to talk a bit more about Blotto afterwards, just for people. There's a part of this. My heart broke as well when I heard what happened. But there's a part in this podcast I like to talk about venues that have closed down, and we could probably talk about the Flapper for another hour after this. But if it's okay with you guys, I'd like to talk about Blotto solely because I remember the day when you guys put up on Facebook, "Is anyone in Birmingham looking for a lockup space?" And me being like a big fangirl and my band needing somewhere, we were in, had an office in the Custard Factory, and Junior's sending me a message. And like right now, I consider you guys some of my best friends. But back then I was like, shit, I'm talking to Junior from Johnny Foreigner. And like my friends from school wouldn't believe me. That sort of level of thing. I know this sounds really, really silly, but like hear me out on it. But when we went into that, into Blotto Studios, like it all made sense to me. Is that like, I got the records and I got the singles and stuff and I got how it was put together, because I mean, going in there and seeing all the equipment stuff lying around, and to some people, albeit my band, who were a bit OCD about stuff, everything had its perfect place in there, and like you knew that you could just go in and pick up your guitar and you were ready to record and stuff. But we'll go into that in a little bit. But you mentioned Screaming Maldini. Let's go into that, because I had a good nostalgia trip with them earlier, as I mentioned to you before. But yeah, take it away.
There just isn't another band that sounds like that. I still find it amazing after all these years. Every band, like, so what would you say there? Like orchestral pop, like baroque orchestra. Every other band that uses that kind of instrumentation either does it with a nod and a wink, kind of in that like Divine Comedy sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like it's a bit of a kitsch almost. Or you're like po-faced serious musicians and you bring in the string section, you bring in the classically trained people to augment your basic ass song.
Yeah.
Whereas with them, like they would put stuff and stagger weird harmonies and stagger stuff in like some weird ass beat. And it would be just as natural as us going like, oh, I think this is the bit where we should all put distortion pedals on and scream.
Like, and get really loud. Like,
yeah. There was something just so joyous and unpretentious about it. Like,
I was reading a really good interview on The Guardian. I say an interview, sorry, just a piece about them. It was written in 2012. So we're showing sort of the years back when they were doing things like you mentioned. Some bands don't do a lot of this stuff. And it says they've enjoyed performing with a 40-piece orchestra. And there aren't really many bands you can think of off the top of my head, like Metallica. you know, there aren't, it's not an everyday thing. Like, and it takes some balls to do. Especially, I suppose, if you're on a label or even if you're not on a label, just organizing that must have been a fucking nightmare for starters. But
like a Showtime, no twist.
Yeah. That was the other band that I thought maybe sort of felt the same way, and that the way they use orchestration and stuff was maybe the No Twist. But those guys are so...
Not seeing them live either, got to be.
They're so German about, like, No Twist started off as like a metal band, and you can see them sitting down and be like, okay, now we will carefully craft orchestral stuff. And it's brilliant, but it's artifice. Whereas with Screaming Maldini, that was just, that felt like naturally how the songs fell out.
It's genius. Like, I was obsessed with both the drummers. I think we did two tours with them, both around Phantom, right? Two different French tours.
We did a French tour and a European tour, I think.
Oh, yeah. And the drums were just way different than all the other bands. There was just like jazz and like proper theory, and it's gone into it, just like the piano playing and everything.
Is that go back to that whole thing about musicians writing songs for musicians that they know can be appreciated by everyone? Where, I mean, you don't just have two drummers and stuff for fun. Like, things like that don't just happen. Like.
Yeah. No, they weren't at the same time. They're just, I think one drummer left and then they got another one, but they were both just unbelievable, you know what I mean?
There was never a weak link in
the band. And they probably had that circle where they could just not, like, it's not pick and choose, but I bet they knew enough well-trained musicians
to be able to... Birmingham connection, that's what I was going to call it from now on, where everyone you know is a musician.
This was Sheffield, they were probably on that way before.
There's something weird in the water up north, like I was doing another podcast with someone earlier on, and it was just the amount of bands I can name from Leeds and Sheffield and Manchester and stuff that you didn't realize that they all knew each other and they were all friends and stuff, because, you know, they all hung out in the same bars or the same pubs or just at the same lockup spaces and things like that. But
I think you could definitely draw an equation between, like, the more north you get, the better bands get. Going to, as I say, like, most of, like, our favorite UK bands are probably Scottish. There's just something, I think the colder it gets and, like, the less away from, like, kind of, like, the ego in the industry around London, then the more people still hack it because they're really good at it, as opposed to they want something out of it.
I suppose there's as best that comes with it. And this is obviously with all due respect, if you're playing in a band up in Glasgow, you do it mostly to just play in a band in Glasgow because you don't have that weird, and I hate this phrase, but the glitz and the glamour of being in London where everyone's a record A&R you're not playing for that. You're playing for the people in your city and for the music, and that's kind of it. And then when all of a sudden bands get big, like Dan and Aykroyd and stuff like that, it probably means a lot more to them as a band because they then realise, oh, we were actually really fucking good, you know. And we were just happy being a band from Scotland, you know, or wherever, really. I guess you can put it to you. I don't mean to just...
That we did with them, they supported us on one tour and just ruined us each night.
Oh.
But, like, they'd come off and they'd be like, how good was that? Did you see everyone dancing? And I'm like, do you not hear what you're playing? Like no one sounds as big and as happy and as joyful. People could not dance to that. Like, it's amazing how... I think the very best talented people just have no clue. It comes so naturally to them. They're just like, oh, I just did a thing.
I was chatting with I mean, quite a few people. This is one thing I bring up again with the guys from Samoans a couple of weeks back, where I've been lucky, like incredibly lucky enough to have chats with people in bands that I admire, like such as yourselves and guys in Blackfish and you know, every other band that we basically discuss on this podcast. And I say to people all the time, like, people don't realize, the people in the bands don't always realize how important they are to the people who listen to the music. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's kind of like Rich Lee from Blackfish and Anya and I is a prime example for me, because I can sit and burn his ear off about music for hours and hours and hours, because I look at him as Rich Lee from Blackfish and Rich Lee from Anya and I as well as my friend. And he doesn't get that in a really like admirable way. It's like, I got up stage and I played my bass and people sing the words back and I have a really nice time. Like, outside of that, you've created some music that then people then go away and listen to for years and years. And, you know,
yeah.
You guys are like, I hope you take that in the right way, but that's how I feel about you guys as well, where it's you two and the rest of the guys in Johnny Foreigner will mean a hell of a lot to a lot of people, but it's a really lovely thing when you just hang out in the pub, you know?
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm.
I hope you take that the right way. I realize I tried to put many, many words in there, but yeah.
I think that's the point of music, isn't it? Like, it's a tribal, it's like an identifier. So if you know someone who's creating the music, you like the Naive Plan at the start of Johnny Foreigner was like, the more shows we play, then the more people that we'll meet who like the same weird ass bands as we were, and then that'll feel better.
A good example, you know, like Miles Joshua Gross, lovely lad. Like, for example, I know he was one of our biggest fans and he still loves us. And he gets a tattoo, pretty much got similar words to what I've got, but I'm for the same actually. But if he pops into my work, like, I forget all that. I just talk to him like, oh, there's Miles, man.
Yeah, but that's it, isn't it? Like, I mean, I'm never going to be in the position that you guys are in to have that, but I admire that, like, that everyone is still just your friends. That goes for everyone who's in a band. That they're, you know. The pedestal, I hate the pedestal, I think, is the thing that people put themselves on. Like, the pedestal is there for people to put you on.
Yeah.
And it's really admirable when, you know, you're just fucking lovely people. Like, that's what really matters at the end of the day.
I'd like to think so, yeah.
Yeah, I hope we're not.
Well, I mean, the fact you said yes to having a chat with me, having not seen you for a couple of years, I think I saw Junior year before last at Soon Festival with Sunshine and stuff, and I don't think I've seen you for a couple of years, Lexi, but that means something that you can say yes to things like that. So thank you, basically, is what I'm saying.
It's a pleasure.
It's flattering that people still want to talk about it, if I'm honest.
Hey, look, well, this is the point in this podcast, is this, it came up, me creating a playlist on the UK Math and Post Rock Facebook page, right, 3 or 4 years ago, just chucked a collaborative playlist on for bands that aren't together anymore that people could discover. And this could be a band that's only released one single, for example, but people are like, I want you to know who this band were. And it accidentally came on my portable listening device in my kitchen, which I won't divulge what it is because there are others available. And I went, oh, I could probably do something about this, like, and talk to people who miss these bands and why they miss these bands and what they sort of mean to them and stuff. But yeah, let's end on a downer, if you will, and let's talk about Blotto, if that's okay, because it was such a big part of your guys' musical career, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know, Blotto was a studio come lockup space come just space, I guess, full stop, based in Heart of Digbeth.
In the Johnny Foreigner records, it's always referred to as Candyland, because when we started, when we first moved in there, it wasn't like, it's not like a practice studio that kind of advertises and needs that kind of business, so like, we didn't really want to give away anything about where it was, and then Candyland just stuck, because because Blotto is really the name of the place that was on the other side of Digbeth.
Yeah.
That they used to have, and then it carried on. But Matt and Nigel are Blotto.
Did we call it Did we call it Candyland for the gig we put on? I'm sure we advertised it that. On the tickets, like Candyland, and the address was Blotto's, but
I just needed a name real fast. And as you walked in, there was all different kinds of, or each unit was painted in like a different gross, like,
yeah, they're just really garish colors. I think it's whatever Nigel could get on offer in Wix or somewhere on the day, like,
yeah. Well, the last couple of years he redid it in black and white, so it was all mono and it looked kind of cool then as
and
well.
It had an absolutely amazing graffiti mural for the last like sort of I'm going to say 6 months. I'm just sort of putting a figure out there for about that time, just before, obviously, got demolished stuff. But I say you want to end on a downer, but that's such an incredibly positive place to have been. I mean, I personally owe a lot to Nigel there, because, you know, and you guys for letting me be a part of what was happening there, because we met so many people in and out there. I remember being told to shut up by the guys from GBH next door. Like, that was a big high point. I was playing my guitar too loud for them, which is not something I thought would be possible. But
I've made them go to the pub on more than one occasion because I wanted to record like a really spindly little acoustic thing. They're so lovely. But yeah, Matt and Nigel were just incredible. Even the fact that like all, at least all the bands on our side were like working bands. We were all our own little separate cottage industries. And the fact that we could run up so much debt because they knew that like come touring season, we'd be in the money and we could
pay it.
Like,
yeah.
So much trust.
They were so understanding of stuff like that. Even when COVID was happening, Nigel was ringing around people being like, if you feel unsafe coming in, then I'm just going to halve your rent. Like, they were just such lovely people. Like, it's really rare you end up reminiscing about landlords.
Yeah.
But
being a landlord is not a job unless you're Nigel and Matt. Like,
but it's crazy. I remember when we first moved in there and we'd be there at like 3 a.m, like tracking drums or something. And it was sort of like Fight Club. Like, we were the only warehouse in the warehouse district with people in at that time of the morning. And then the last few years, I'd be there doing stuff at 3 a.m. And I'd feel like mine was the only warehouse with only one person in. Like, everything had been filled up. And
yeah, my stuff. They opened quite a big, was it called Boxed or something like that, just over the road in there. There's a lot of event space thing in there.
Yeah. And it kind of started to get a bit sketchy again around there. I got mugged outside there, which is just the price you pay for having like cheap lockup in city centre space.
That nightclub, yeah. They used to put that night on. The only downer that I remember, getting back at like 3 a.m. and having to go through loads of club goers.
Yeah.
It turns out matters. But now it's like the floodgate, I think, where they just do like table tennis and that.
Nice sort of middle age sort of night out.
I just don't think there'll ever be a place like that in Birmingham again. Not somewhere that, with that kind of enough space to be affordable to people who can't necessarily pay that kind of like premium money.
Yeah.
Somewhere where you can be 24 hours on your own and make as much noise as you want. Somewhere that close to like the centre, to bus routes.
And now you could have just loaded into like the mill and stuff by just carrying your app like 150 yards up the road.
We've done that a few times. Get some supermarket choice. Yeah. Just like
trundling horses.
Trundle around.
I remember playing a show with Milk Teeth and Love Buzzard good few years back now at Talk Bar, which again is another venue that's not there anymore. But I remember being able to load out of Blotto, get in the car and be at the venue in like less than 5 minutes. Then finish the set, load out into the car, drive the stuff back and then walk back to the venue ready to see the next band, because it was just such a perfect location for it.
Yeah.
It was one of them places. I know what you mean. There's not necessarily going to be somewhere like that because of the community that it brought together. Also such contrasting people in the best possible way. Like, you get a great education from, especially a musical education from people that came in and out of that door. Like, I mean, also the beauty of it is you could just let someone in that you knew, because if you didn't know it was there, you didn't know it was there.
Yeah.
Someone knocked on the door, it's because they wanted to get in because they knew what was going on. And all of a sudden, you know, like I said, it's the guys from GBH being in there, and that's bizarre sort of set of circumstances and things. But
yeah,
it was a real good place to be a part of, and I'm glad I was a part of it. So I got to thank you guys for that, obviously. But
yeah, it was a pleasure having you along while it lasted.
Yeah, but I mean, there will be somewhere like that, but it will take someone to want to recreate that sort of idea behind it. It might not be in the same place or have the same sort of feel, but the community side to it, I guess.
Yeah.
That takes the people that are involved to pull it together.
That's the story of every city, isn't it? Like, the cheap bit where the artists are, the artists make it cool, everyone else moves in. And in addition to that, there's like HS2 and everything coming in from the other side.
Yeah.
So it was sort of inevitable that at some point it's all going to be bulldozed and turned into restaurants we can't afford to eat in.
Yeah. They're just like pushing the musicians out, sadly. So, yeah. That was a bit of a downer I ended on there, but I'll end on a positive thing by saying this has been an absolute pleasure to chat to you both again and see that you're both doing well. Actually, quickly before we go, your poetry. I've heard there might be an album on the cards. Am I allowed to say that?
The album is on the cards. Yeah. First single is out on the 18th of March.
Yeah, so we're dropping the first single from the album, 18th of March, on Alcapop. It's all very exciting.
Cool.
The album we recorded with Tom Lydwell, who also did Beat Dyslexia.
Mm-hmm. And nice sort of background to begin.
Yeah, he's like that guy now. It's crazy. Well, for us, anyway.
It's the first time we've ever recorded a session where I haven't had to give the producer copious notes after. He just got it so good.
Amazing.
That's great.
Yeah. I'm thoroughly excited for that record. When it'll be out, and obviously the new single, I believe this podcast will be out after the single, so people will see it, but when I'm pushing it, obviously we will be making sure we get everything there. But also for all the bands and everything that we've mentioned today, I'll make sure that we've got all the links, everything in all the comments and everything. And also, thankfully, because of sort of the Birmingham connection that we've got, I'll put all the acts that those bands are now in and stuff and how it goes from there as well, because it's a beautiful sort of family tree of bands when you actually get to look into it. So that'll be really nice to sort of do a bit more research into as well. But Junior, Lexi, thank you so much for joining me on this, and good luck and everything in the future. And hopefully after all this is over, I will see you soon. Let's do a Cardiff show. Let's make it happen.
Nice one.
I've got more than just a floor for you to sleep on, so that'll be better.
Nice. Fine, man. We're workers now, we get travel lodges.
Oh, okay. All right. Big that's right, yeah. I'll rescind the offer then. All right, take care, guys.
Later.
Thanks.